kill her. I didn't divert it off, Conrad. If we take the theory of colours used by artists in painting, the theory of pigment relations, it isn't the same theory that is used by scientists in analysing colour relations. But the pigment way of analysis is traditionally older than the scientific one we now use. So when we're talking about the symbolic meanings of colour in ancient traditions, we will use the pigment relation, in which case we start with a triangle and we're going to put on one side blue, on the other side red, and here yellow. It can be seen in the case of pigments that to colour red cannot be mixed. We must start with a red pigment. In the same way with blue, we can't mix it. We have to get a blue pigment. And with yellow, we can't mix it. We have to get a yellow pigment. Because of the fact that we cannot mix these colours, we call them primary colours. If we mix two of these colours together, yellow and blue, we will get green out of them. If we mix red and yellow, we get orange. If we mix red and blue, we get violet. Now these colours are derivative and we call them secondary colours. All our symbology is derived from the meaning of the primary colours. Red belongs to the will and to the desire side of nature. So we'll put will over there and desire. Blue belongs to the intellect, thought. And yellow is neither hot, like the red side, nor cold, like the blue side. So we use yellow and we call it the colour of the mean, the balance, because it does not move us either towards desire or to intellectual activity. You'll notice you talk about red passions and blue moods. A blue mood is a mood when the intellect is dominating. And if you remember that the intellect is a negative instrument devised to control the desire side of life, you'll understand that a blue mood is the mood where your thought process is in operation and has gained the ascendancy over desire, which means in effect that desire has been inhibited. So if we want to treat a person with a colour therapy, if the person tends towards a red activity, that is towards a desired rhythm, a blue colour will make him feel cold, will tend to depress him, to pull down his desire reactions. If we find a person with an intellectual mood dominating, it will usually, in most people, not be a mood of constructive thought. It will be a depressive mood. So that many people think that blue is a depressive colour on its own. If we find a person alternating between these two processes, what we would call a cycloid kind of person, whom one minute is full of desires, and the next is thinking how foolish it was to be driven by desires, we apply yellow to them, the colour of the mean. And yellow stops the intellectual process and the desire process simultaneously. So that in a very, very simple way, we can see that from the primary colours, we can derive a symbology that is useful as a mnemonic to remind us of how to think about these relations. If we take the red side, the will and desire side, and add to it some of the intellective side, we get violet in the centre, and slightly towards the red side we would get the colour red-violet, and slightly towards the blue side, blue-violet, and the purple side is slightly on the red side of violet, which means to say that it has intellection with a slight tendency to pass into action. This is why purple is the colour of monarchs. The monarch is not allowed merely to think, normally to act. He has to balance his thinking and his action, and this balance is in the purple. If you remember that the pur in purple is fire, and the ple, which means fold, is also the pilo or rational function. So pur ple actually means fire or will and reason. So to wear the purple as a mnemonic, for which reason monarchs wear it, is in order to remind yourself that you have two sides to your nature, and if you feel very pushed by desires, it is time to use the intellect, and if your intellect is tending to inhibit action, it is time to release a little initiative will. If you look inside the word violet, you'll see the yo of God, the jo or yo of the Hebrews. The V, as we saw before, means development, and the LT function at the end is the conjunction. Again, we see that the vo here belongs to the red side, to the volitional side, and the LT belongs to the intellective side. This T means form, and if we take the whole function of this in the middle, we see the function of divine interrelatedness of the two. Violet gives us the perfect balance. If we put it on the blue-violet side, it means intellection is controlling the act. If we put it on the will side, it means that for the time being, the will is pushing the intellectual side. If you take a man engaged in a fight, it wouldn't do for that man during the fight to be dictated to merely by his intellect, because the speed of the nervous impulses is relatively slow when it is controlled consciously from the central nervous system, which means that every consciously controlled act is slower than an instinctive act, which means that you can't fight adequately using your intellect only. So a boxer in the ring, even if he's good technically, has to put the stress on the volitional side of his nature, in which case he would be entitled to stress the pur in him. He's a fireman. This is origin of the word pure, incidentally. Purity can only come out of experience, out of the fire of experience. Only experience is able to purify anyone at all, because in a complex situation it is impossible to eliminate the toxins, the poisons that block both volition and intellection. You know, in your nervous system you have certain cumulative effects of poisons through using the nervous system, and the same with the muscles. The phenomena of tiring in muscle and thought is really the result of toxin generated in the process of using those organs, and the only way to get rid of it is by this fire process. So that after a period of activity you have to relax, and in that relaxation a certain kind of work is done, your temperature has been raised, and there's a certain kind of elimination process going on which leaves your body actually cleaner than it was before you started to use it. So in relation to the red-blue side of this triangle, we have a good indication of a practical use to which we can put it. And here we have to turn to the real purpose of using a magical symbol. You know that magical symbols are credited with power, but they have no power for a person unless the person understands precisely what is the meaning of that symbol and how it is to be used. Now, all symbols, whatever, are used magically simply as supports for consciousness and a means of exaltation of the will. The will of an ordinary person is very, very negative. That is to say, it cannot bring itself to do something against resistances. So, in fact, we say that, in general, there's no call upon the willpower. But if something happens, if the house gets on fire, or an accident occurs, quite suddenly volition manifests itself and things are done that would not be done in the absence of such stimuli. The magician is concerned to stimulate his own volition without waiting for a fire or for an accident to happen. He wants to be a self-stimulating system, and therefore he will utilize any means whatever to guarantee inside his own organism a continuous presentation of the control idea. So if we look at this triangle, I'll draw another one up here and we'll compare the two. If I put now the blue over here and the red here and the yellow here, I'm using the triangle, which would be used by the Latin Church to symbolize the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. The reason why they put the base of this triangle at the top is to symbolize that the Holy Spirit comes equally out of the Father, that's the energy side, and the Son, that's the intellective side. So we could write up here the Logos, that's the principle of universal logical thought, and up here the Father, or Force, and down here the HS, or Holy Spirit. Now, the Holy Spirit is said to egress equally from the Father and from the Son. So in that sense, the support of the universe is above, and the natural colour of Father and Son together in their mediation is purple, because creation is actually going on now. In the perfect equilibration of violet, there is no actual creation. The thing remains in pure potential. Whereas the moment the time series has begun, it is evidence of a disequilibrium. The force of action has dominated the force of static thought. You know that thought does not get into your muscle system, into action, unless you emote about it. And emotion is emotion, it's emotion outwards. And if we take it roughly that the forebrain is concerned with intellection, and the back part is concerned with the motor responses, the middle part is the part where you emote. The thalami themselves have very, very strong emotional connections. So that when you think mathematically in the forebrain, you do not necessarily move. In order to turn a thought into an action, you must first emote on the thought. That is, you must work up an emotion about it. You must feel about it. If you don't feel, nothing can be done. In the case of some mental disorders where apathy is present, we have very, very great difficulty, because in the state of apathy we have a perfect static field. And unless we can cause an emotional response in the person, then nothing is going to change. If we can get a person to respond, even if only in anger, we can do something about it. But if they won't respond at all, there's nothing to be done about it. So first of all, in the case of apathetic ones, we have to find some mode of getting at their feelings. We know there is such a mode, because every being has these three colours, or these three modes in them. We have somehow to get at the feeling centre, which frequently means going down to association methods into quite early experiences of pleasures and pains. But when we can cause an emotion to arise, we can guarantee a reaction. And once we have a reaction, we can determine the direction of it. You know that when a motor car is standing still, even with the brakes off, when you try to push that car, it requires a lot of energy. But once the thing is rolling, then it is easier. In the same way, if you try to steer a car which is stationary, you will strain the steering gear. But the moment the car is moving, it is easy to steer. So once we've broken the initial inertia of the standing car, we can steer it. Exactly in the same way with a human being. If we can provoke an emotional reaction, then we can start to steer the person. And if we cannot provoke an emotional reaction, we cannot steer the person. This is the basis of propaganda and any kind of suggestive technique like advertising. First you must rouse the emotions, and then you can point them in the direction you want. And unless an emotional reaction is forthcoming, nothing can be done. So if we compare these two triangles, we build one from the material side, we can say, as above, so below, But the image is an inverted image. You remember in the case of the Solomonic star, the two triangles were placed one on top of the other. And the analysis we're going to do, we're placing them like this. And we're saying that whatever is above is below, and the image is inverted as in a mirror. So if we place a line across here, then we can say this triad is the divine triad, and this triad down here is terrestrial. We can actually say, therefore, that the lower you go, once you've gone below the median line, the nearer you are getting to God by becoming more materialistic. If we say this is the baseline of pure materialism, and that's the baseline of pure spirit, as you are coming down from spirit to the intersection point here of the two, it is on this point here where the ego of man is formulated. So that if a man wants to become divine, he must either go down or up. He cannot stay on that middle line. Aristotle thought you could, and he recommended it and called it the golden mean. But he had misunderstood the nature of this red-blue relation. The golden mean, kept on all the time, will miss everything, because life proceeds in waves. So if I say here's the mean between it, that's an abstract idea. If I will not observe the fact that people in the mass are sometimes wildly excited and sometimes wildly depressed, if I stick on the middle line here, I will go through the world untouched. Now that is an ideal to aim at for self-insulation, not to suffer from contagion when the masses become excited or when they become depressed. In order to do so, you have to pull yourself down during elation, knowing that the more you pull yourself down, the less you can fall below the median line, until you come on the median line deliberately. But that median line is only a line from which you depart deliberately. Supposing we say, therefore, that in this case, this corresponds with the red and this with the blue. That is, there's a rising line of action, desire, volition, and here is an intellective, depressive state. We want to get out of this excessive action because it always leads to depression. So we bring ourselves by practice onto the median line. But we do so only in order, in given instances, deliberately to come into this line and perhaps not go down into that line. If we have sufficient self-control, we could rush about with the herd when it's excited and then not be depressed afterwards, because we have deliberately conformed to the demands of the moment. This is the real meaning of expediency. In expediency, expediency, out of the necessity of putting your foot down at a given moment, you might insist on being wildly volitional, because there's no time for thinking. Sometimes you actually have to precipitate a situation. And at other times, when everybody's being very wild, you may have to become rigidly intellectual. This you must do deliberately. In order to do it deliberately, you must first practice pulling down this process of volition, with the result that the intellective state is brought up. Remember that if you don't allow a state of elation, you can't get a feeling of depression. So when you're feeling elated, you pull it down, then you won't be so depressed, and you gradually get it till you get a simple vibration on the median line. The median line then is not a static concept. It is a highly dynamic concept. You can see, in fact, in this diagram that if we take the rise up and then the fall, the length of the wave is related to the height of it here. So we say the pitch of this wave is related to the length. So if we pull it down a bit, we'll find the waves getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And when the waves are short, we say the frequency is high. So short wave, high frequency, consciousness is gained simply by pulling down during periods of elation, which causes not so much depression, but the consequent shortening of the wave, until eventually we can actually do two things simultaneously. Namely, we can use our full logic intellect and our volition simultaneously. With God, to think and to act are identical. With human beings, we find two kinds of activity, Promethean activity and Epimethean. Promethean activity is forethinking. It's the basis of insurance. The live bird on this building here is a sea eagle, a cormorant, tearing out the liver of a person who feels he must get insured. Because, if you remember the story of Prometheus, because he insures his future by forethinking, Prometheus needs forethinking, he stole fire from the gods, and the gods decided to punish him, and they sent down to him a lady named Pandora as a wife, but he was so busy forethinking that he thought there was something the matter with the gift, considering where it came from, so he wouldn't have it. And his brother Epimetheus, afterthought, took Pandora for a wife, with the result that all the troubles of the world, which we know of, were let loose. Now Prometheus is that insurance tendency, the tendency to play safe, to predict one's future by resting on the material probability theory. So when we are going along, we have to think, if we try to insure ourselves like Prometheus did, forethinking, we will get liver trouble. But the mythic statement is that an eagle, meaning the intellect, comes and tears out the liver of Prometheus. And when he goes to sleep at night, well then his liver is repaired a bit, and when he gets up again the next day, he does it again. So his life is actually spent tearing himself to bits in the day and trying to mend himself with life at night. So we have to consider the rising ambitions here and the depressions that follow the failure of ambitious enterprise, and know that whatever we allow ourselves to purpose, if it is failed, if we fail to attain our purpose, there will be a corresponding depression. This is the meaning of the statement in the Tao Te Ching, he who does not declare his aim cannot be said to fail. If instead of declaring your future aim, you simply get on with your present work, and your present work has this threefold basis, that it is a work involving volition, intellection, and feeling in between. By feeling, you translate intellection into volition. By volition, you can apply in the material world the truth of an idea. But you can't get it into action in the material world unless you first feel like it. And this state of feeling like it, of letting the energy run outwards, is what we call emotion. So, in the relation here, if we take the ego point in a man where he says, I am I, it is the lowest point of the divine triad and the highest point of the material triad. Now, you can go towards ultimate knowledge either by going up or going down. As we said before, if you go up too high, you'll come down. So, if we now extend this line a bit, and we start a wave where an individual decides to go to God in one easy lesson, he sees an advertisement, I regret to say it's usually in an American newspaper, called Scientific Prayer or something. He immediately essays to pray to the Absolute for the Studebaker. So he prays, but unfortunately all the other millions have got the same lesson that week, and they're all praying simultaneously, and the Studebaker output doesn't quite hit the market requirements, so some of them become depressed. They're forced right down to the material fact. So if we put the spirit up here of God and the material down there, we can say that when the man tries to get to God prematurely, it follows that he must crash down into the material world. The degree of his fall is the degree of his aspiration. This is very, very important. The original fall, inside which is a very, very cunning secret of the prodigal son, the fall of Lucifer, is the statement of the attempt to usurp the position of the Absolute with the resultant crash into gross material manifestation. So if we really wanted to go to God without falling down, and remember, we can't fall up. We never get by inertia to God, the Spirit. We can only get down into the material world by inertia. We have a gravitational pull on us. This pull bends the spine down. It contracts the bones, it slips your discs and so on. It does not lengthen the spine. It doesn't make it aspire to the spirit. It drags the whole of the organism down. In fact, when people's energy level gets quite low, in later life, they actually lose 2 or 3 inches in height, not only through stooping, but through actual loss from the body, through the simple giving in to the gravitational pull. So if, then, we are to avoid this crash, we must do something to avoid it. That is to say, instead of waiting to fall down, we must go down. And this is what science tries to do. And the external empirical science deliberately goes down into matter, knowing that it can't fall down if it's right at the bottom. If it once hits the fundamental material base of the universe, it can go no lower. So that any further development will be an improvement. So when we come right down to the baseline here, and we know that the whole forces of nature are tending towards that baseline, we know we cannot go lower than the final, ultimate particle of matter. So we'll forget about God for a moment, because we know that this baseline is the reflection and has exactly the same significance as this one, the Divine Spirit, if we understand it. This is why Jakob Böhme, the German mystic, said, the worst, that is the bottom one, is as good as the best. If we come right down to the baseline here, we find, in fact, that we can study the behavior of inanimate matter. Inanimate matter actually behaves, which means to say, if you get a very good experiment to persuade a man to get hold of, say, a steel bar, and take it and grip it very, very tightly and hit as hard as he can against a lamp standard. Now we know that if he hits very, very hard, the reaction in his hand will hurt him considerably and he will drop the bar, wondering precisely what happened because he intended to hit the lamp, and he's forgotten that to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if he hit the lamp very hard without a relaxed hand, he's taken the full shock of his own force back on his hand. So when we hit this material world, we discover it has a very peculiar property, that is, the property of reaction. And this fact of the reaction of inanimate matter shows that inanimate matter is animate inside. The word inanimate does not mean not animate. It means that the animation is on the inside, as opposed to the outer. Now remember, we talked about circumscription. Matter is simply a rotation of force. So if we consider that anything which exists materially is simply a structure of rotating forces, we can understand precisely why it can react. And to make sure that we do understand it, we'll draw another one here, a conceptual particle which corresponds with nothing whatever. That is a conceptual particle which I've shaded deliberately to pretend that it is solid, and that solid means absolutely without any space whatever in it, and that therefore it cannot react. If it had no space in it whatever, it would be absolutely rigid. And if it were absolutely rigid in this sense, reaction would be impossible for it. Whereas, in this case, we know that there is a very real possibility of reaction. If we hit this very hard, we actually compress it. And the amount of power in it, the mass energy, as the scientists would call it, is quite determined. Therefore, when we hit it, we actually add something to it, and in distorting it, all the forces inside try to spring back, to stop the force acting upon it, and to regain its initial shape. So that, in effect, if we get an apparently solid object, like a billiard ball, the mass energies in it are quite high because it is dense. So if we give it a good hard knock, we'll get a good bounce off it. If it were very, very soft and non-elastic, as we call it, if we hit it and bent it, it would stay bent, it wouldn't react. So when it does react, it is evidence that there is power there which we have distorted in the process of hitting it, and that power is hitting back at us in the same measure that we hit it. And this fact that so-called inanimate matter is simply matter with the animation, the soul or power, inside it, and we act upon it from outside, it then acts back on us. So there is power inside it, and it will react. That is, if we stimulate it, it will stimulate us. Now let us say this represents the world now, the earth. And that earth was precipitated under certain conditions by a determination on the part of prime volition divine to make itself a platform from which to work. So we'll now say this little line, the base of this triangle, is really a curve. Here it is. And this is the earth. And here are some radiations coming into the earth from outside it. And the power inside the earth is responding to it. So that when a force hits the earth, something bounces up. Now, the thing that bounces up initially on the earth, we can say, without becoming too involved in the process of evolution, is the vegetable world. The vegetable world springs out. Sometimes rabbis call the vegetable world the hair of the earth. If we remember that hair, HR function, equals power, then it is quite correct to say that this is the hair of the earth. The plant world is power springing out. That same power, later on, will produce animals, and the animals, with the power derived from the relation between forces outside and in, will run about, and it will eat the plants and add the plant energy to its own, and gradually there will emerge a man and eventually a superman who will know the sources of these energies. So in this diagram we're having the divine force outside here and the material force here. So in this two triangles in this diagram are represented here with an imaginary circle outside to represent the top triangle and this precipitated circle inside to represent the earth. So there is no difference whatever in kind between the reactions of the mineral world and the plant, the animal and the human world. Which means to say, if we study very carefully the nature of material reactions, we are studying spiritual facts. That is to say, there is nothing unspiritual in the world. In the case of the distribution of nervous impulses in the body, there is an electrical effect, there is a chemical effect, there is a thermal effect. Physiologists would say that the chemical and thermal effect act in the nature of support to the electrical effect, because the electrical flow of impulses is conditioned to a certain extent by temperature and by chemical situation. So when we are talking about the gross material world, we can actually analyze that world in terms of electrical, chemical and thermal effects. So when we come down to here, we're studying a triad again. So inside here we could pretend there's a mysterious triangle belonging to this one, which is exactly the same as that one up there. I'm drawing this triangle below this line, but we should really think it to be drawn here on the line, coming out at right angles to the diagram, so that we can say inside there there is an electrical, a chemical and a thermal effect. We know that when we put electricity down a wire to light a lamp, there's a field effect around it. And we know that there's a chemical effect and that there is also a thermal effect, the heating in the wire. Just as it is in this case, we're using the energy stored up from the sun in coal, abstracting gas, and the gas is burning and it's imparting its heat to that asbestos framework, and that's radiating the heat into the room. It's all a question of the translation of motion. We said that the material world is simply forces in rotation. And we know that this concept of spirit is the same as the concept of force. So the material world is simply a spiritual precipitate. In rabbinical terms, we could say that the material world is the excrement of God, which simply means the ex, the outer, cre, ment, that which is created outside for counting purposes. Excrement simply means push out so that we can count it. Now, in another diagram, we could say this isn't the earth anymore. That is an egg of a human being before he develops. Inside the egg, there is a little centre, the nucleus. In that nucleus, there is intelligence, there is force. There are two factors. There is a force and there is form. The form, we say, is the principle of heredity. let us say it is in the genetic factors, the chromosomes with their little genes on them, and those forms inside under certain conditions of the nucleus will proceed to divide this egg, and they'll cut it into innumerable little cells before differentiating the form. We therefore have in the nucleus this cup triangle. So this is another way of looking at the symbol. We can put the divine triangle in there, and we can put the earth-based triangle there, and say this one, the nuclear triangle, is the one from which all development is controlled. We know this to be a fact, because if we take the egg and cut the nucleus out, the rest of it will die. Whereas if we take a knife and cut a bit off the protoplasm surrounding the nucleus, it will not die, but it will be repaired, which gives us factual proof that the nucleus contains two factors. There is a force corresponding with volition in us, and form corresponding with intellection in us. So however we look at this thing, we are presented with the meaning of these colour relations. There is the force, red, we put force in there, and the blue, the intellective side. The blue, the intellective side, is in there, hereditaments, form. And the red is the force which will actually be applied to part that cell into many cells and then differentiate it into a human being. Now, we know for a fact that if we get a microscope, say an electron microscope, and we examine the constituent particles of the nucleus of an egg, we do not find inside it a little genius sitting there waiting to get bigger. We find no such thing. All we can actually find when we come down to the material level here are primary rotations and aggregates of such building up to atoms and molecules. Now let us take this again as the image, and it doesn't exist factually, the image of a primary particle so defined. We can see that it is not a man. And yet we know by this nucleus, which is built of such things, that although it is not a man, it can produce one. And we know from first principles that we cannot get anything out of that thing unless it is in it. So, and yet we have defined it that there is nothing in it. So if it be true that there is nothing in it, we can get nothing out of it. Now, in fact, we do get something out of it, namely a human being developed. It therefore follows that even though there's nothing in that, there is something in it. Now, if you want something in it, and at the same time there isn't anything in it, you will have to define it in a special way. And therefore, we define it in the way that we have to, and call it a door. What there is factually in there is a door. This is the meaning of Christ saying, "I am the door." There's a hole in the wall. In Tao-Te-King terms, its use is precisely because there's nothing there. You can go through it. Now, because this thing is a conceptual particle, we can say of it that it is a door. Inside there, there are actual particles, which we can see under an electron microscope, and of themselves they could never become a man, but nevertheless men develop. Therefore, the only alternative is the man is in the field. That is to say, we must now posit the field down here, the divine and the terrestrial. So we now put that dot inside the Solomonic star. And we remember the divine triad, and we remember the terrestrial triad. Now, in Chassid Doharic terms, the rabbi would say, everything below is the same as everything above. So that when a man, red, we'll call Red Eve if we like for this purpose, we'll turn it upside down later, man is a hermaphrodite, an image of God created ye then male and female. Red, desireful woman. Blue, intellective man. Put them both together. Now, rabbinically it is said, we're coming to our favourite glyph now, of the Doric and the Ionic columns. Before Eve was taken out of Adam, it is said rabbinically that they were together side by side, and it was no good. He was all one, there was male and female in him, but they were side by side.
And being sound by sound, they couldn't produce anything. And because of this fact, God took Eve out of Adam, and they then came face to face. And in coming face to face, they actually then proceeded to generate. And they got themselves a baby serpent, which later got them into trouble. So, when we look back at this egg nucleus, we find that the actual material particle cannot contain a man, and nevertheless one appears wherever there is such a nucleus. Therefore, we know that the field energies contain these two principles, form, which is masculine, and volition, which is feminine. And this probably surprises people when they hear that a man is intellectual, or that a woman is volitional. But if there is careful thinking about it, it will be seen that all the drive and push in a marriage comes from the side of the woman, because the man is concerned with the formal analysis of situations. Remember, it's the man that takes the clock to bits. It's the woman that makes him go out to work to buy a new one. This occurs both inside the individual, because he's hermaphroditic, and also in the relation between man and woman. Now, on this here, we may write, this base, we may say red for ladies and blue for gentlemen. And the statement is that it's red for ladies divine and blue for gentlemen divine. There. So it is said that there is nothing goes on below that doesn't go on above. So if a man and a woman marry on earth, rabbinically they are said to have already been married in heaven. So if this is the heaven line here, it is a force line. Remember, this is positive relative to this. It is your will, if you've got any, that acts on your body and says, hand, hold, chalk, draw. The chalk doesn't say, pick me up and draw. But the will and the intellect say, I will pick you up and draw. So we say, this is active up here, and this is passive down there. So in this diagram, the divine here has already made a marriage. It isn't very, very trusting, really, because you know very well that young fellows and girls go out and they go on, what do they call it, in Liverpool? Is it the Monkey Man or something? Lover's Lane, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And they go down there in droves, whatever it is, in every town. But they don't respond to everybody, do they? They just go, and suddenly the two boys who are out hunting together will say, those are all white, whistle or something. Now, the marriage has already been made in heaven. That is to say, in the conscious part of themselves. And they will now be driven to seek a physical confirmation, because the attraction already exists. Actually, what causes this attraction is prior experience. We'll come back to that later. Every girl you like, you've already had an affair with in a special sense, which we'll discuss later. Even if you start, if you were one, or like the Bantu, if you were, you know, the Bantu are very, very incestuous. It is said that if there were twins in utero, one a boy and the other a girl, the girl would not be born Virgo in tacto. That is said about the Bantu, and it's fairly true. Actually, what causes this attraction is prior experience. We'll come back to that later. Every girl you like, you've already had an affair with in a special sense, which we'll discuss later. Even if you start, if you were one, or like the Bantu, if you were, you know, the Bantu are very, very incestuous. It is said that if there were twins in utero, one a boy and the other a girl, the girl would not be born Virgo in tacto. That is said about the Bantu, and it's fairly true. Now, this means to say that the germplasm in you is actually immortal, and that all the experiences, sexual, that your ancestors have ever had, of whatever types of beings, are engrammed upon your tissue in that nucleus. So that if you feel biased towards a particular woman, or a woman is biased towards a particular man, it only means that she's already had experience of that type and found it all right. And if you feel that you don't like somebody like Dr. Fell, although you don't know the immediate reason, nevertheless, you've had ancestral experience on this and found it very unpleasant. So, when a marriage is made on the earth plane, it is actually posterior to this marriage made on the heaven plane already. I remember we said the material world is simply the spiritual world inverted. That matter is only spirit force rotating. So we don't have a dualism. We don't have a problem of how does a non-material spirit manifest in matter, because matter is spirit. Matter is a modal activity of spirit. Rabbis say, therefore, if it be true that every marriage on earth is previously made in heaven, then once the marriage has been made in heaven, there is nothing you can do on earth except obey. This is the origin, incidentally, of the anti-divorce laws, because if you be truly related to that person, and it's not been a marriage of convenience, you can only force on. If it's a valid, polarized, biological relation, then it is better to keep it up than to break it. If you break the relation down here on the physical plane with a divorce, you then cause a break up here. A recent book is, American book is called Emotional Factors in Pulmonary Tuberculosis. Now, what they're finding about it is something that you can infer quite easily from this fact. Many of those people are people who had thought that they had married out of love, and then they thought that they had made a bad choice, and they then become emotionally very confused, and this emotional discharge acts on the lungs, particularly being the medial place between the volitional and the intellectual. So if the marriage is not simply a marriage of material convenience, and is biologically determined, ideally with equal zeal on both sides, then to break it is merely to break the relation at the material end, and the polarized relation remains. And this is why when a solid biological relationship has been broken through economic forces or social forces or the influence of other people, when they're physically driven apart, they still don't forgive each other. They're still tied to each other, and they still condemn each other and assume that something could have been done other than was done. So we find here the rule is, don't break it down there if it is valid biologically, because every biological tendency you have is valid at its own level, and the breaking of such consummations of relations is the chief cause of modern neurosis. We'll come back later to this polarized diagram when we come to consider this. I'll draw a little triangle here instead of going up there. I'm going to draw now the Solomonic square again. Now with them both over each other. And I'm going to put the middle line here. And I'm going to let this, you may have seen this in the British Museum or reproduced somewhere, and this. Here is a gentleman up here, the Macropospus, the big face. This is God himself, completely with whiskers. And down here is represented as water, which is the symbol of plasticity. And down here is a very miserable face, the Micropospus, with his mouth turned down, looks like he's turned up from this angle. And his beard meets his beard, and his hands hold. And this fellow down here is light in the dark waters. But this fellow is dark in the eternal sea of light. So we then have two triangles. The water here, which in Genesis is called the waters below the firmament, in a circular diagram, this fellow is inside here, and he is outside. The firmament is the circumscription. There's the waters below, namely inside. What is below is inside. And what is above is outside in this diagram. So this big face, the Macropospus, is there, and the Micropospus is here. To keep it simple, we'll use this diagram. This is the plastic matter, or receptive substance of the universe. And inside it, the divine here appears as light. That is to say,
that the intellection of a man, the consciousness of an individual within the material world, is the only right he has as an individual. So he is the light of the world in the plastic world. In other words, a human being, as a humanist believes, is really the light of the world. But it is only the inverted reflection in matter, and matter is rotating in spirit, of a spiritual being whose form is dark in an infinite ocean of light. If we had absolute light with no darkness whatever, we would have no form or content. We must have some mode of introducing differences. We'll see in a moment why colour is so tremendously important. But at the moment we'll confine ourselves to a colourless analysis, namely black and white. If we had an infinite ocean of light with no interaction whatever, we would have consciousness with no object, and it would be quite useless, valueless. Value implies duality, combat, struggle, victory. So that in the infinite ocean of light, symbolized by the white paper, we find that the divine being appears as dark. Now the first dark being we hear of is the devil. And it is this very principle of form in the absolute field of light which is the cause of what we call intellectual activity. This is absolute intellectual activity. That intellectual activity is the one that Lucifer was proud of. Proud, we'll find out later, is a phallic euphemism. That is to say, it has to do with a certain kind of energy packing. When we get this dark being up here, appearing as God the Father, it is the energy aspect. When we get him appearing as the form, it is the intellectual aspect. And that is inside the infinite ocean of spiritual light, and that infinite ocean would be quite useless if we hadn't got the form in it. So we then take the Father, making his dark sun, and because the sun is dark and formed in the formers, Jakob Burma calls him the counterstroke. The sun is the counterstroke to the Father, which is another statement about the Oedipus story. And again, it's a statement about proud, because Oedipus means swollen foot, and that is a euphemism. So we have this generic energy here, which is formative power, applying itself in the material world here, a plastic possibility, whereupon it inverts and appears as light. So that all the things that we call light are ideas, and you know very well that every idea that we have is a circumscribed zone interfering with consciousness. Consciousness itself, without object, is useless, and with object has interference. The interference is the object. So that an ob or orb thrown in, ject, an object thrown in, we call it the great interjection, into the absolute ocean of infinite light, there was thrown the ball, Omar Khayyam says, the stone that puts the stars to flight, awake, etc. That ob was thrown, ject, into the infinite ocean of light, and therefore became a formal precipitate upon which intellection can proceed to make inferences. That is the letter Yod in the Hebrew. In Hebrew, with a square pen, it's written like that. Primarily, it was simply a circle. Now, that same Yod, which we will now put up here for God the Father, it's the first letter of the tetragram. Yod there. Yad is Hebrew for hand, it means the creative hand, and that's another euphemism. Really, this is the positive sexual power of the universe. And it has an opposite power, which is called He. So if I write Yod here, and then the letter He, the Hebrew letter there, that is the name Yah, which is itself said to be a very, very great mystery, because it means boys and girls, or ladies and gentlemen. Man and woman, positivity, negativity, activity, passivity. It means a whole series of things, but they are all polarized in this way. So this Yod here, in its reflection, becomes another letter. The fourth
letter is hey, we'll see, and the next letter is what?
This letter we'll call vowel to make it easy to hear. Sephardic, we will call it vowel. We'll call it vowel. We will simply put a long tail, there's a yud, or we'll put a long tail on it like that and call it vowel. But we'll write that vowel upside down here. And we'll say that that vowel is simply the reflected form of the yud. Now this vowel, if I draw it for you in Egyptian hieroglyph, you must forgive me because it's a euphemism. You see? There's the Egyptian hieroglyph for it. It's simply the male genital organ. And it's made very, very simple like that for quick writing for scribes. And scribes are generally intellectual, so they wouldn't want to be bothered with its biological function. So they simplified it. And therefore, the man down below here, the microcosmos or pinhead, as we call him, is a reflection of this creative God above. And therefore, the whole formal principle of the absolute is vested inside the genetic principle in the sperm. It is not in the ovum, we'll see why afterwards. It is in the sperm. All this water here represents, biologically, when we reduce this back to a circular diagram, it represents the ovum, the egg, that a woman carries and really is. And all the form inside the egg that a woman carries has come from the male side of her family. That is, she gets her form from her father, from her father's father, from her mother's father. She never gets it from a woman. She only gets it from the male side, because only the male side is experiential. And nevertheless, women are very formed, providing they have formed daddies and granddaddies. Now you see that in this diagram we have a highly complex relation which shows itself as two triangles, one belonging to the divine and the other belonging to the terrestrial, and that the terrestrial one is simply the divine one inverted and established by rotating the forces in it. So we have to take this diagram and reduce it to this one in order to understand it. But as we don't want to give it away to Tom, Dick and Harry, because they invariably abuse it in three different ways, we have to put it back in the form of this Solomonic star again, so that when we come to meditate on this, a yogi would call this a yantra. You see, you put a dot in the middle. And that dot is that genetic principle. If we put a circle around there, we would say the whole thing represents the egg. That represents the nucleus. This represents the divine initiative in it, and this represents the material receptive side of it. This represents the logit term, or the intellective side, the formal side of the genetic principle. This represents the desire or active initiative side. Here is the mean between, which ties them together in exact reflection with the other triangle. So there is nothing in heaven that is not already in your physical body. This is the meaning of the statement, the kingdom of heaven is within. If you understand that you can't fall if you're right on the bottom, you deliberately go down into the material situation, you attack the very, very root of matter, and solve the material problem, and upon it, you may then raise yourself to the Great Pyramid. Because you are starting from there, and we know that the Great Pyramid was a very funny one, because although it was perfectly designed, no top brick was put on it. The top brick was left off by the architect in order to symbolize that the infinite is really the top. So the rest of it is concerned with building from below. We could be as euphemistic as we like about this, because building from below has various aspects. And we could say this baseline is the material world, if we are talking scientifically. We could say that it's the mass of people, if we're talking politically. We could talk about different levels along here scientifically, about things that are climbing up until right at the top here we get catalysts. very magical substances which cause things to go on down below. And in the same way, inside the government, there are people who don't do anything, except when they appear, somebody else does something. The Tao Te Ching represents it by saying that when the state is in disorder, the emperor rustles his robes, and whereupon order is resumed. If a man could build himself a reputation like, say, at the lowest level, Churchill has done, then an ordinary person would tend to be intimidated by the presence of a man if he knew that man to be Churchill. Churchill had a devil during the war, so did Montgomery. If you met the devil and thought it was the original, you might feel a little misease about it. But if you knew he was only a devil, you wouldn't feel quite so bad. Now, the difference between the two feelings is the weight of opinion which has been generated around the manners and aura. But if you remember that the dot inside there, the nucleus, is the centre of power, then you know immediately that if that represents the body of Churchill, it is certain that not in the material particles of his organism, which isn't the very best, most beautiful organism in the world, could arise such power. But there is a field around him, and the field has two aspects, namely the formal content and the volitional content. He has been trained superficially in certain aspects of this, so he knows when to shout, and he knows when to pretend to be reasonable. The Tao Te Ching says it very quietly by saying, "He who, being a man, can remain a woman, has finished his work." That is worth meditating upon, because it contains what the rabbis would call the mystery of faith. The mystery of faith is a lovely term. So, if we remember that there is in us an unformulatedness, a power, which tends to move, and a precipitate form, which is useful as a guide for such movement, then we can begin to train ourselves. I'm going to draw that little diagram of ours here a bit and talk non-euphemistically about it a bit. When Adam and Eve, that's the Doric column, and this is the Ionic column. Ionic is from the word Ioni. Ioni is simply the female. And you see, here are the fallopian tubes. They're put on the top here as decoration. Here are the ovaries, and here are the tubes, and this would be the uterine chamber itself. Now, the fallopian tube is so called because through it the fall occurs for every being that comes into this world. If we were to draw it in another way, like this, we could draw it. Sometimes it is so drawn. We say, inside there are a lot of eggs. A baby girl is born with them. She is a woman at birth. She's got lots and lots and lots of potential beings, their bodies. But those bodies have no souls in them. That's very important to realize. We said by the particle that we examined before, there was no human being in the particle. The human being is in the field, around it. But the chemical precipitate which makes the particle is in a definite resonance relationship with the field. Because matter is simply spirit modularized in a certain way. So if there is an egg there with a certain chemical content, when that egg is fertilized with another similar thing, with another chemical content, the two chemicals put together will produce a certain compound which can respond to certain intelligence vibrations in a unique way. So when the egg is released, it actually has no power to move itself, so it's pushed along this tube. This is its downgoing. Little hair-like processes kick it along. Meanwhile, an initiative principle, this whole thing is a bit if we call the well, and this thing is called the stream down here, and it says, a well fed by a stream. Meditate on that, because in it lies the mystery of faith. So every person now in the room has fallen down one of those tubes in the remote past. That fall isn't really a fall at all, it's a push.
There are forces along here, resident in these little processes, you see there, air-like processes, kicking that thing down. So it isn't really a fall at all. It's what Nietzsche would call an Untergang. It's down there, it's being pushed. Hence the step, did he fall or was he pushed? You see? Now he gets in here. Sometimes one of these energetic little fellows down here, who is a form packet from a male line of experiences. Incidentally, the mystery of fate is also called the mystery of experience, or prodigality. This is prod, and this is gal. So this fellow frequently is so zealous that he swims up here, and before that egg had got time to get really kicked down, he started operations upon him. So when finally this rolling stone gathering no moss beds itself in here, it proceeds to develop. And it is the product of one force polarized into male-female. The relation in a sexual relation is said to be face-to-face, rabbinically, as opposed to the relation side-by-side. Eve was Adam's sister before she was his wife. In the relation side-by-sideness, there is brother and sisterness. Hence Solomon says, my spouse, my sister. Because all relations between human beings are incestuous, either closely incestuous or distantly incestuous. A lot of the so-called bars against incest are economic, but the valid ones are biological, but they've all to do with the value of form. The real purpose behind avoiding an incestuous relationship is simply because you don't want to repeat the same forms over and over again. And the more formal the differentiation you can get, the more stimulus value there is, the more vital is the being that results. If you keep inbreeding back, the tissue itself becomes more or less opaque to spirit. And so there's less and less effort, less vitality appearing through it. But you see in this diagram, which is this pillar of our symbol, that the fall of man occurs every time a baby is born. Now here is another part of the mystery, that every egg that comes down there is developing by partitioning itself and then going through various stages, and one of the stages through which it goes is the female stage, and every man has been a female. That is to say, at a certain point all the development proceeds by volition and the form has not got the dominion. There's a continuous internal process of urging, of feeling and so on, which keeps it whole. But when the differentiation inside it, inside the embryo, reaches a certain point, if it goes over that point and becomes more formally charged, it becomes a male. But if the formal content becomes latent, it is a female. But we all go through the stage of being relatively formless before we become formed, which means that every man was a woman once. So the difference between man and woman is again a relative polarity. There's no absolute difference between man and woman. Some women are nearly male, some are very, very feminine. Some men are nearly female, and some very, very few men are very, very masculine. A really masculine male and a really feminine woman would be practically useless in modern society, because they wouldn't have the compensating factors to be able to integrate themselves into a modern social context. So when we look at the aeonic, aeone means the female organ, the aeonic head on this one, we are to remember all this and meditate upon it. So then when we look at our diagram, we will say, here is the female, here is the cause of the fall, here is where the fall takes place. It is only in conjunction with the female that we can call it all. That's very important. You will then see the Genesis references to it. Now on the other side we have a Doric column, which is very blunt, and if we were to curve the top of it and make it really phallic like that, it wouldn't be architecturally so very good as a support. So it's made a bit blunt, because it is a bit blunt, really. It's not very intelligent at times. But here it is, and this, in conjunction with this,
produces the world. That is to say, all the actives and the passives produce a manifestation between them. We put across here a tie to symbolize their relation. And this tie symbolizes the yellow, if you like, the medial line. This column is blue and this is red. And here is the yellow line between. Now, that yellow line is simply to remind us that all polarization is dual, and all duality presupposes a prior unity. So that horizontal line there represents the primal unity from which these two polarized entities derive. So masculinity, femininity there, and in between the unity from which they both derive. That would therefore be the line of universal substance, and substance is not matter, it is spiritual power. Matter is only a modality of it. Now in our diagram we have a dot in the middle, which is simply that letter Yud, restored to its original circular form. So that these two together are H, and the dot is the dot on the letter I. This is the Yud, Yot, Jot. And therefore we have the letters IH. And we said before, IH, Yud, He, are the two first letters of the name of God, which is translated Jehovah. So that means male, and this means female. So that H signifies the whole field. And the whole field is polarized, and the formal precipitate there determines which will be stressed at any given moment. And then we have drawn from this center line, because that dot represents the ego center between the two triangles here, the divine triad and the terrestrial triad and the dot. So that dot point is put on the line here, and this is now a tightrope on which an individual man is presuming to balance himself. We've represented him there as a serpent. Now the serpent is, in a certain sense, God and the devil simultaneously. We'll try him in a new diagram in a moment. Meanwhile, we've made him turn towards the Ionic column, which we said before was the female column. And it means that the intelligent individual, even if he's a man, will actually be prepared to study women. We'll have to find out what the word study means later. Because they contain the great secret. If they could articulate it, or would, some of them can and will. If they would, or if you could persuade them to, then you'd know all about it. Because in actual fact, hidden inside a woman is the potential of reason that a man thinks he's got, only she won't use it. She has very, very good reasons why she shouldn't use it. We'll go into them later. So this principle of form here gives rise to the individual who is the serpent. Now, we remember that ser means toothed, and is a basis of free, and pent is the root of hanging and thinking. You can translate it free thinker, if you like. You can also translate it on tooth hanging, hanging by one's teeth. The ser is the root of differentiation of spirit. All intellection, all analytical work is based on the differentiation of spirit. In other words, we must be quite clear in our formulations. And then we must be prepared to pen, notice, to contain, to practice continence, about what it is that this lady tells us when we talk to her in serpentine tongue. Because actually she'll tell you a lot if you ask him very, very, very nicely. Usually it's a very old lady that tells a young man what a naughty woman another one is. If she's sufficiently old and she's given up the game, she will actually advise the young man about what it's about. But she wouldn't be when she was young. So if you can find a nice old lady and ask her pertinent questions, she'll tell you something about it. Young ones will.
except on the special occasions. So when we look at this diagram, we now see three letters, I, the dot, H, and S. Now, for certain reasons, the word validation was left off. Somebody thought it occupied too much space on the letter heading. If we had put it in, it would have meant victory. We can assume that for some reason of destiny, as the V means to triumph through actualizing potentials, or even if you like, putting in publication, for the time being it has been suspended. So that the whole words, bells, IHS, which you know in the Christian symbology, to symbolize in his service. And you know that the letter H is a woman. So that when you say in his service, you mean her service, in a special sense. And the woman that you're referring to is the lady called, by Christians, the assumed Mary, by the Chinese, Kuan Yin, by intellectualists, universal substantial illumination. But it is quite definitely a feminine thing, because it won't speak except under certain conditions. Silence is its name.
We do have the V in the address.
We do have the V in the address. We'll keep it there, won't we?
Yeah.
Mm. So, shortly we come back to say that any device, such as this, is a support for the mind to stop the mind wandering, so that you can force your mind to stay on the same subject and to analyze the interrelations of these things, and then to find out their equivalents in your own nature, so that when you see that dot, say to yourself you mean clarity of thought. When you see this H, say you mean your whole feeling awareness. They're exactly opposite. An infinite field of awareness, your hay value, and a formal, clear thinking process, your yud value. And in the field of awareness, there are two terms, namely a volitional desire side and a formal side. You know, in Jiji Muga, Japanese theory, the one is the other. That is, a woman is a man and a man is a woman. The rabbis said it in a nice way, and they said, when God was making Adam and Eve, he took a little bit of bone of Adam and he put it into the bottom of Eve's heart. And then he took a bit of flesh of Eve and he put it into the bottom of man's heart. Which is why men are soft on the inside and hard on the outside. That's a good rabbinical statement. So when we look at this, we have to remember all that we have discussed now, and deliberately, if we wish for the benefit as individuals, and only individuals get a benefit, we must go through all of this and then ask ourselves, quite truthfully, how much in me is woman, that is unformulated willfulness, and how much in me is man, that is formulated willfulness. Notice the difference between the two. The only difference is that in one case it's clearly formed, ideation, in the other case it's not. The woman keeps her will in a feeling state. She's, if you like, eternally ready for anything. But the man is trying to formulate himself so that he can be ready only for some things which he determines himself. If you have exhausted all the serial meanings of such a diagram, which a yogi would call a yantara, then you hold it in suspense in the mind, in its totality. I remember what we said last year about this. We have withdrawal of the sense organs from the external world. We then have concentration of the energies within upon some object, say this diagram. We must then discursively meditate upon it, which means take it to bits, run around it, analyze it until we have completely exhausted all the serial content, everything that's in it, taken separately, one at a time. And when we have exhausted it, we put the whole thing back together again into its prime unity. It is now a synthetic unity. Before we analyzed it, it was
an unanalyzed unity. Then we analyze it and it became a plurality. Then we take the plural bits and put them back and it is now a synthetic unity. And we then hold that synthetic unity in our mind and we call this stage contemplation, not meditation. Meditation is discussing and contemplation is simply holding the total meaning of that diagram. And when you hold the total meaning of such a diagram inside yourself, various things happen. Because of the amount of work you've done on it intellectually, there will be a certain redistribution of intellectual energies in you, so that your ideas, if they don't agree with the result of it and are false, will be forced to migrate and change their relationships. This has to do with the history of the Jews, externally. There are certain cells inside your body which are the chosen people internally. They are destined to rule, but they are not in the right state to rule until this dispersion and then recollection of tribes has occurred in the body. When you have got the rational effect out, you will also find that in holding the object, contemplating it, there is also a total feeling arises from it. And you'll find the particular character of this feeling, in its wholeness, is always profoundly good. And yet, at the same time, you're feeling the goodness of it and the fact that you're really glad you did it and that you're now bigger and better and more powerful than you ever were before. Particular parts of it, we call them sub-entities, will be dissatisfied because they have been disrupted and their attitudes, which were irrational, have got to change. So in the midst of a completely whole confidence that you're right, you feel odd little niggles. Now, you get hold of this whole feeling and hold it and look at those niggles while you're holding the big feeling, and you'll gradually notice that they try to fight you, to overthrow the wholeness. You put the weight of your will on the side of the wholeness, and they gradually realize that they cannot win. And when they're quite convinced they cannot win, they migrate into their own proper relations. And the whole gestalt, the complete constellation of forces inside you, is equilibrated, and there is then a complete transcendence of that situation. It is no longer problematic for you. And when you're dealing with a diagram in this order, or this Solomonic diagram, or this one genetically, once you have held it in your mind and comprehended it in that way, there will be certain subjects that no longer bother you or even interest you because you have transcended them. The Tao Te Ching says daily deal with less and less. If you do this, dealing with less and less in this way, you deal with less and less because you are dealing with more and more. That is, your symbol is higher, so it eliminates the necessity for petty niggling over a wide variety of subjects. You finally discover there is only one subject, and that subject is the mystery of fate. That is, what is the precise relation between boys and girls?
As Maurice Chevalier has been singing recently quite a lot about this, it must be in the air. The relation between these is one determined by the essential qualities on the continuum of which they are both polarizations. So that if you take a diagram in that order and meditate upon it to the point of exhaustion of its serial content and contemplate it, you will actually cause the whole of your organism, because remember that matter is only spirit rotating, the whole of your organism to come into a new kind of harmony that you cannot attain any other way. We could go on to other things, but I'd like if you have any particular questions about this series of ideas.
Suggested something a little earlier when you said manageable natives have one natives. he mustn't make any more income.
If you've already made one, you might. Yes. Assuming that was the right one?
Yes.
Of course, you won't. If it wasn't the right one, well, then you will, won't you?
Pardon?
If it wasn't the right one, you will.
Yes, but you said if you were attracted by any kind of woman, you was the right one. There must be more than one right one.
Well, you know, this is one of the mysteries of faith. But the fact is that the one that you commit yourself to, biologically, you'll have an extreme difficulty in getting rid of it out of your system. Because there is a real interchange of forces between you. Before the physical fact, certain forces exchange. In the physical fact, then material forces also exchange, and you are no longer the same person. You'll actually find it extremely difficult to get rid of the other half which you have absorbed. It's very, very often necessary to give you permission about certain aspects of it. If you consider the nature of the diagrams very carefully and meditate upon it, then a hint is enough. See, lots of the men in the Old Testament frame were not immediately struck dead for having more than one wife, were they?
No.
Everything depends on the different factors. You know that biologically you have certain factors which become latent and they hide and they don't show in the child, but they're still there. And the expressed personality is only a part of your potentiality. And the things that you haven't developed, which you might develop, will be transmitted into the next generation. So if you have a child, those things you didn't develop may develop in the child of that child. And if they do, they will resound to someone that you might have married if you'd have been born in a different time. All relations are primarily incestuous. And every man that gets married is still marrying me.
If we all came from Adam and Eve, there must be incestuous.
Well, we know that the physical fact that we all came from a specific kind of egg, which became human, whether we accept biblical symbology, which is symbology, it isn't supposed to be anything else, of a biological evolutionary process. Or the scientific statement about it, that we have evolved from a specifically qualified egg from a specific animal underwent a certain mutation. The fact is that whatever theory. All relations are primarily incestuous. And every man that gets married is still marrying me.
If we all came from Adam and Eve, there must be incestuous.
Well, we know that the physical fact that we all came from a specific kind of egg, which became human, whether we accept biblical symbology, which is symbology, it isn't supposed to be anything else, of a biological evolutionary process. Or the scientific statement about it, that we have evolved from a specifically qualified egg from a specific animal underwent a certain mutation. The fact is that whatever theory we take, at a certain point historically, science would say a certain mutant occurred. That corresponds with the symbolic statement that after all the plants and animals had been made, man was made. If you look in the Genesis story, man was not made on earth first. Because it says, these were all the things that were made before there was a man on earth. And it's already said man has been made. Man was made first in this formal field, then precipitated into the material field.
That's one of those difficult questions, really. The more you try to concentrate on it, sort it out, the more confused it becomes. If you just let it remain vague, it seems better.
Yes, but letting it remain vague is the same thing as staying where you are, knowing your spot. commence. You're Luna.
Would it be better, Jean, to just sit and watch it?
Watch the mental process?
Yes.
But that's your necessary first step. Because unless you really do watch your mental process, you will not become disgusted with it. If you do have the courage to watch it, unbiased, something you will come to the conclusion that it's rubbish, which it is. And so the mental process is entirely determined before you have exercised yourself by stimulation of your organs continually to your five senses. So there's nothing in your thinking process except the mechanical responses to your five sense organs. And if in fact there was nothing higher in man than the five senses, we couldn't even begin to work to integrate them. The fact that we can actually deliberately coordinate vision and hearing, or touch and taste and smell, means that there is something higher than those five sense organs. This something higher, philosophically, was called the common sense. Now, common sense is very rare, isn't it? Today we say common sense, and some people think it means the sense of common people, but it doesn't mean any such thing. It means the sense that is common to the five, which is the basis of their possible integration. But the common sense itself is the substratum of the five senses. Over and above that, you must have initiative to decide whether you will look or listen. So the common sense has an initiative factor as well. So you have five senses, common sense, point of initiation. So if you watch your mind, you will discover that most of these processes are tautological, and they go round and round and round and round and don't get anywhere. That's mechanical self-stimulation following external stimulation. Every external stimulus gets its tail in its mouth and goes round and round and round, so that the whole of your thought processes, as coming from outside, are cyclic. So if you think for a very, very long time, you'll find you're thinking exactly the same thing as you were thinking before. For which reason, this process in the mind is called, mystically, the ring pass knot. This cycle of definitions that you can't get out of. But if you deliberately cut into it with initiative, analytical power, then you will discover that every time you cut into an idea that you've never analysed before, you will find energy that you didn't know you had. Two ideas are bound together by a certain amount of energy, and they produce a complex idea. If you haven't analysed it, you've got a packet of form there, and the energy in it is not available for your use. But if you split it into two, the energy that was binding it is now free in you, it's not about. It will try to find a target. So, very frequently after analysis, you suddenly feel you ought to do something now. That's the loose energy. And that is the one time when you should do nothing about it. You should allow that free energy to go into its own place.
That's the watching again.
That's the watching again. The whole thing is to get consciousness to do the work for you. Consciousness is a catalyst. And if you don't interfere with egotistic bias, everything must go into its own place. You know, when Christ says, I do not judge, but if I judge, I judge righteously. The lower ego, when it judges, is judging on the basis of the five senses, and its judgment is rubbish. Because it's conditioned entirely by factors that are irrelevant to truth. And if you cut out all private purposes and just look at the situation, then the inherent differences of the situation present themselves to consciousness, and there is no confusion. It doesn't need an effort of will. If I hold up two fingers, you need to see the one's longer than the other. Does it?
No.
Personal bias would say, well, it isn't really. I hold it back. Sure it is. You say one thing about me. If I hold it like that, you say none. If I pan my hand that way, so that my index finger is shorter than my ring finger, you say I'm an extrovert. If I pull it the other way and show it to them, I'm saying that I'm not. Because for all ordinary persons, those things are done mechanically. And the rule applies. So we can say that all rules, empirically derived, apply to all people in the group. But they do not apply to people who know the rules. Because people who know the rules can falsify all the expressions if they wish. That's one of the modes of freedom, the ability to change phenomena.
and thus to present a situation with a new stimulus. If you allow the mind to run without egotistic bias, without worry, without Promethean activity, without hoping that it will come out right, just commit yourself to truth, nothing else. Just say, if it's true, it's better for me, ultimately, than a lie. And the truth I can only know if I don't comment. The yogic term sakshin means the faithful witness. The witness just witnesses, he doesn't say anything about it. One man is 5'6", another man is 5'9". There's no comment, you see it. But you don't say that that's a little runt, and that's a big potato, and he's rotten, and so on. Those are comments which are determined mechanically, and they don't help at all. If you just see the difference, let the difference speak to you, everything goes into its own place, and there is spontaneous integration of things at their own level. Children do it, unless you condition them to do otherwise. So the children say very, very peculiar things that their parents have to stop them saying, because they have the innocent eye, and they say things like, why has that man got a black face, man? And she says, that's not a black face, that's just a colored gentleman's face. When those things happen, the child has a perfectly innocent eye, and left with that innocence, and given the proper education in other matters, the child would become human. The tendency is to try to stop that innocence because it's socially inconvenient. Because people have such tender souls, and they can't afford to be told that their ears are wrong by a little child. The thing is to gain the innocent eye, or the pure witness, or as Christ said, become a little children, all of which are different ways of expressing simply the unbiased observer. And then when meditation is done in that way, you are watching the content of your mind, and you are merely watching it, nothing else. You don't need to do anything else. People who watch their minds and interfere with the thought process to try and put it right, put it wrong. Because there is only one right place for every idea, and that is in a constellation of other ideas in the same reference frame. And the individual cannot possibly know where it should go. But the pure witness, looking at it, can see where it will fit. And it keeps moving until it comes into its own place. And like a coal sort of our tongue.
Is that what causes agitation?
Oh, yeah. The cold sorter out is a good image of it, because that vibrating, running table that lets two pieces out here and four pieces here.
But when you feel that there's something not right in the situation, or it appears right, rationally, you really feel as much as you can logically in the situation, it was still an underlying feeling of rather dissatisfaction or disequilibrium.
Yeah.
That is fine.
It may not be in the part you've analysed. As we said before, when you've got that whole thing, you can have sub-entity objection to the analysis, because you've not yet analysed the whole universe. The part of it that you've done is quite correct, but the part that you've done, although correct, is in the wrong room. When it's moved into a new context, the whole analysed thing, then it will fit exactly. If we analyse this diagram at a certain level, say biologically, that's only a part of it, it'll fit there. Suppose we come to apply it sociologically, in a social theory, what does it mean? The thing actually means that cunning gentleman serpent will deliberately give votes to women to get a stampede vote, doesn't it? In other words, you would deliberately tell them that they're marvellous, they're wonderful, they're intelligent, they ought to be in the House of Lords. He won't believe it, but he'll say it. So there would immediately come a jar inside the organism, wouldn't there? Certain men who've got lovely wives would say, I don't agree. And some other men with very powerful wives would say, I don't agree. You see, and very powerful wives would think, I do agree, but I won't say. Because she knows her weapon. A weapon is will. A weapon has always been will. And it is the weapon of the Taoist. But the intermediary weapon is reason. Isn't it? Very euphemistic, that one. reason means that relating power, doesn't it? So it is the intermediary power. Ultimately, you come down to the point of willing, actually willing. And if you are actually willing consciously, it's all right, but it's being woman. Whereas when you haven't had enough strength of will, you will reason to find out how to do something that you haven't got the power to do. Remember that Cain means that thinking power, and Abel meant the willpower. And the Cainish power killed the willpower by overthinking upon it. In other words, Cain was like Prometheus and Epimetheus. If you think too much about a venture, you will paralyze your will. As the fear of the will results from overstimulation of the intellectual center. It pinches all the energy that should go into motor nerves and so on. You can actually get a process of energy in the body circulating in the intellectual department, telling you exactly what you ought to do, and simply because you have thought it, you cannot, because you've used up all the energy in thinking about it. Now that serpent says there, turning towards the lady sign, leave just a little bit over for doing something about it. And yet you can't break through into will until you complete a process if you are a man. A woman can, she doesn't need to break through a thought process, she just will. But a man can't break through into the will unless he completes his thought process. He can't even regress and become a woman, it's too late. It's very old, isn't it? More men die than women do it, you know.
Is that the idea where you've got a lot of these men, they seem to get a great delight in dressed up as women? Are they tending towards that womanishness?
They haven't left it. They haven't left it, you see. They've only just made the grade into men.
So a tendency of women is there with them?
Oh, yes. They've only just got through. They've only just got a little bit of that extra formal chemistry to allow them to become sufficiently developed physically to become men. And they've only just made the grade.
So when we treat them with contempt, we're misunderstanding
them. Lack of understanding. Everybody's been a woman once. About 42% of men have only just made the grade. About 4% are physically demonstrations of their middle nature. There are changes of sex from woman to man, fairly commonly. There are no recorded cases of a real man regressing to a woman. There's that pseudo case of Roberta Carley, who was intersex in the first place. But there aren't any cases of developed men becoming women, because it would involve the most weird thing, namely the abandonment of gained form. It would actually be impossible for them to put it down from themselves. It might be possible conceivably by some fantastic radiation brainwashing device or something, or by some chemical attack, but it couldn't be done by a man, because he would have to do something no being will do: abandon power. Because the evolutionary process is through will, through form, back to will. From undifferentiated will, through differentiation, which is form, intellection, to synthetic. When the whole of your intellection powers are synthesized and become a new kind of will. A will that knows exactly what it is doing and why.
Is this true then, that any man that was man enough to father a child could never become a by change of sex? There's a story about that.
Well, only newspaper stories.
Actually, the
mathematics is a good one that has gone the other way. That's right, yes. Roberto Carlo is probably the most publicised example of that, by the BMA themselves. Published a statement that it was untrue, and he wasn't a proper man. I mean, it's a terrible thing to absorb that appendage, isn't it? Which is what you have to do. It's easy enough to grow one, because I've already got one. Small. But to actually get a large one and absorb it, it requires a terrific reversal of energies for no advantage.
how do you think that your sense making in such a condensed form, which is very, very hard, as the gentleman over there said before, to sit out and to try and to really understand symbolically, to really meditate on that symbol that you've drawn there, and meditate and meditate and keep meditating on it. The problems that arise solve themselves if you watch it.
Oh, yes.
The problem solves itself.
Yes, yes. You know the idea of the rabbis wearing a box on their forehead and then on their arm, the lectures, and inside them they have little quotations from the Old Testament. They seem to remind them. So when that box was on there, behind there in the forehead is the control centre for the individual will. There's your administrative executive power on the arm. There are certain passages written down. So when you look at that, you remember that passage. When you look at that, you remember something else. If you were to remember that when you met any person, you would say to yourself, in every situation, if there are two people or more, there is a polar relation. In every polar relation, there is active and passive. Am I being active or passive at the moment? If there are three people there, one of them is playing the serpent, balancing on that rope between the other two. Who is it? Is it me or one of the others? Yes. You work on this symbol all the time. And you say to yourself, do I want to be free or bound? I asked a very sick boy this last week, when he thought that he was in a very, very bad way. And I said, do you prefer freedom or bondage? He said, freedom, I suppose. Do you prefer truth or fantasy? Well, truth, I suppose. And after a series of polar questions, his answers all added up. He'd rather be free than bound, he'd rather be a man than a fantasy, and so on. He was clarified about it. He began to knit together. He began to become less negative. In the same way, in every situation, look through the situation with that symbol. Each symbol has a specific kind of stimulus value. So if we take the circle and the cross, it's a very, very simple thing. You look at the situation. The circle, to me, when I put it on this present situation, is the limit of the subject matter we have undertaken to discuss. The vertical in it represents the active side of it, and the horizontal, the passive. The passive is the material with which we are dealing, and the vertical is the energy with which we are dealing with it. So we can control our thought. So while one man is trying to keep up with the subject and forgetting what it is, by a simple device we can make sure that we don't lose the subject. If we were discussing football, we'd say, football is what we're discussing at the moment, not fox hunting, that's outside the circle. We draw the circle, we define it, and we won't have any other subject in unless it's relevant. And then we say the material that we're discussing, the material aspects of it, and the forces involved. And by means of that simple diagram, which is only the sky and the sky, we are concerned with these active-passive polar relations inside a defined environment. If we use the device, it will help us. It will put things in place. If we don't, we'll gain a benefit.
That is the validation involved, isn't it?
That's the validation.
Your conscious of it is still in the tongue.
Oh, yes. Oh, I did put it in the tongue.
Is there a paradox here with this man and woman business? Because so the man you're inclined to regard as masculine is really full of urge and will and determination to do things, and the thinking man you're inclined to regard as one is inclined to regard as
Well, the reason for that is it's quite easy to understand. The man in general who corresponds with the one you're thinking about is what we call an intellectualist, isn't it? So he's deficient in initiative power. Now, one of the things that we worship in the world is power, isn't it? And the male in general has greater muscular force than the woman. He's externally harder, isn't he? Those people who are externally soft try to make up for it by internal form, namely intellectualist activity. So they're externally women, and they're trying to be men on the inside. See?
Yes. What about the other example then?
The case of the man who is hard on the outside, he may be a real woman on the inside. Some of the toughest rock climbers I know are very, very, very nearly women. Emotionally and volitionally. Some really tough sports, including racing motorists, who are externally tough and hard and internally quite feminine. There's a polar relation between the inside of the thing and the outside, you know. There's actually an electric polarity between the inside and outside of a muscle. The outside surface of a muscle is positive and the inside is negative.
It's
like
a soldier with half a man and a hard soldier with half a man.
Very, very soft, isn't it? The natural soldier, not the conscript, is a real woman on the inside. He loves sentiment. He's always thinking of the spoils of war, which he interprets as a nice quiet night with his head between a pair of bosoms. In other words, he's talking about how to be a little baby and get back to mama again. Last night there was a play about Hitler, did you hear it? There was one remark in there, the author either picked it up out of a biography or heard it somewhere, because it was quite valid. A man who'd been terribly tough, when he heard that Hitler was dead, could only think of one thing. He had to go to bed with a woman. You see, it wasn't a masculine urge. He really wanted to go back out of all the trouble, go back into the womb and stay there. It was nice and quiet. Because his leader had died. It appeared superficially like a masculine sex act, but it wasn't. It was a purely regressive act, an attempt to get out. And you have to be very careful about that, because very often the man who is easily perturbed sexually isn't masculine, he's feminine. He's still attracted to it. In this regressive manner. In Indian philosophy, they deal with this and deliberately try to encourage it. They say that the husband contains the child, the brother, the husband, and the father, all rolled up into one, the perfect mate. Now, in actual fact, teaching that to the Indians tended to turn them into babies, not into farmers. Because they thought that's another good reason why we should be up there.
And that program needs to be ruled at the top when the man has a really horrifying situation put to him and a very severe emotional experience. He went to look for the woman. He went to get drunk and then look for the woman.
Yes. It's all back to mama. I'll be comforted. It's true.
Well, then it becomes an escape, doesn't it?
That's right.
It's kind of escape.
That's right.
Reading a book is an escape, isn't it?
Well, anything can be an escape. It doesn't even work.
Yes, it can for some people.
Yes, yes. Even mine alone. And I found that escapes by chopping wood very vigorously.
Before, when you said that we have certain ideas that keep rotating and we also split them, and that energy would be released.
Yeah.
We weren't to do anything about it. The energy would find its own place.
That's right.
Well, what does happen? Does it become a new reserve of energy, or what happens to it?
Well, it runs about and it's at a certain resonance. And because the idea that you split was in any case a false alliance between forces, it will go about and according to its resonance, it will tie itself to an idea that it should belong to.
Could you?
But if you allow that energy to run out, and it's most obviously a leakage, is to tell somebody what you just thought of. You see? That line of least resistance onto the tunnel is an initial enemy. If you analyse a thing and immediately tell somebody about it, the energy which is released is going to muscle activity on the tunnel. And creating a line of least resistance which really disqualifies you for talking you permissively about the real mystery of faith afterwards.
You've really lost something.
Yes, definite amount of energy. And the person to whom you've said it has gained it.
Yes.
Well, you've done them the good instead of yourself.
Yes, if they can keep their mouths shut and get lots of people to keep their mouths shut around them, they'll be fine. That's another secret thing, isn't it?
Well, that's
interesting.
You understand also there's a reciprocal feeding going on.
That's coming. Oh, that's a higher level. If you understand that, you can afford to talk.
Well, that becomes a spot to catch your mouth, so you might get a better one from them.
That's right. Could be.
You said you mentioned something about the importance of colour before you finish, have you?
Yes, well, the importance of it from the point of view of effects on yourself is to use it as a mnemonic. So that whatever you see that's red, immediately say to yourself, what is my desire state at the moment? What is my will state? What action tendencies are there in me? And if there are any other persons out there, say, what about that person? What is there in them? And then the same with blue for intellection, and the same with yellow for balancing. Now, in actual fact, if you do this over a period of time, you will discover that when you look at a certain person, that person will actually appear to you to be red or blue or yellow, or combinations, as if you could almost intuit. If you become more sensitive, you'll actually see such colours in them, and in the feeling of them, changes. That you see around somebody a certain kind of colour vibration. So that you have a mnemonic system. Every time you go out, you've got colour as a stimulus. You've got a bit on the tie there, and you've got the opposite colour in the rest of your shirt, haven't you? That's about. It's a red purple, isn't it?
Maroon.
Yes. Well, we have to analyse all colours into red, yellow and blue. That one is a red, red, blue, isn't it? That bird, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a red with a slight blue in it. And the rest of the shirt is a grey with a blue bias, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes? With a little bit of practice, you can see that one, that pullover there, that's red and yellow, isn't it? Darkened.
It's
brick, which is red and yellow. That one there is a red with a slight bit of blue in it.
Yes, you can actually see the yellow in that.
You can see it, can't you?
Yes.
With a little bit of practice, you can see it. And then you gradually find if a person is dressing according to their own taste, and not according to fashion, in other words, they have an habitual way of dressing in colour, it is an index of their psychological state. In other words, it's a giveaway of the kind of person it is.
Well, that's the one thing that I was really interested in. Different people have a feeling for a different colour. I'm wondering if it is something lacking in
them. Oh, yes. Well, if they lack a particular colour, they are deficient in it. They need it. They actually need it.
Is that why I don't like red?
Well, it would seem to you to be a disturbance, wouldn't it? The return.
I mean, I never were red, look it that way. So I support Liverpool.
That's another reason, isn't it?
I would never think of putting a red tie on, for instance.
No.
Or a red shirt. Or red socks.
In other words, you don't want to aggress openly, do you? In the environment. You don't want to attack.
No.
Isn't your specific mode of living, is it?
No.
Nevertheless, you like the colour you've got on there, don't you?
It's not as severe.
It is red there, but it's got blue in it. So that you've got this intellective process in you. Mixed up with the volition side. If you clarify the will element and the intellective element in the two, when they're separated out, you're all right. But until you separate them out, one of them can fool the other. Just like the thing you mentioned, you support Liverpool. That is really irrelevant, isn't it? Because the reason why you support Liverpool is because you're in Liverpool. And because you have relations in Liverpool other than colour relations. So you actually endure a colour that you don't like because of another reason. So that when you're meditating on the reason why I support Liverpool, the first reason would not be because they have red shirts.
Why? When everything wears blue.
Well, you don't live in
anything. Oh, it makes no difference. I know that's blue.
Liverpool people, I suppose, haven't they? They don't
yeah, but if you examine those people, you find they have a very good reason for not supporting the whole town. They have a concept now themselves.
Young children seem to show a preference for red, don't they, before any other colour?
Yeah.
As they get older, they begin to
colour. It's a nice stimulating colour, isn't it?
And yet, on that triangle, yellow seems to be the mediation between the silver dark. And the common association is that yellow means calories.
Well, what a balanced man always is called a captain, man and balanced man. It's a historical fact, the fellow who doesn't rush in is called by the man who does, if he survives, to call him anything, a count. And Aristotle's concept of the mean is a cowardly concept, because it was done to avoid trouble, not to balance other people. He liked to avoid trouble for himself, and therefore for him it was a bad thing. The real meaning of that yellow is not simply to avoid trouble, it's in order to balance powers, which can sometimes be very troublesome, to keep the mean between two opposing arguments.